Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names, and now part of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode is with Darren Brown, who is on Broadway right now with his new show, Secret. For those of you who don't know him, he's this UK phenomenon. He's a mentalist, he's a hypnotist, he's a mind reader, he's an illusionist, he's an author. This guy is incredible. And I don't even know where to start. I don't know where to end with this introduction because I just can't give away any of the secrets. I went to his show. I actually got called up on stage. I don't know. I was part of one of these tricks and I still don't know how he did it. It's just incredible. You've got to go see the show. That's really all I can say. I don't know. I don't know where else to go with this. Other than that, it was really impressive to me that He was very introverted, very humble, and it kind of, it's the opposite of this, you know, big stage presence, charismatic guy that he plays during the show. So it was nice to have an intimate conversation, as the tagline of this podcast claims. So everybody, before we get into the episode, visit me online at thetheaterpodcast.com or broadwaypodcastnetwork.com/TTP. Show your support at ttp.fm/Patreon. And now everybody, please enjoy this episode with Darren Brown.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Here you go, 1, 2, 3.
So this introduction, I actually have to admit I plagiarized from your website, but from stage to screen, two-time Olivier Award-winning Darren Brown has mesmerized millions worldwide with his unique brand of mind-reading, persuasion, and psychological illusion. Now, for the first time ever, this UK phenomenon and Netflix star brings his talents to Broadway for the first time in his newest show, Secret. Darren Brown, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
That was a very nice introduction. Thank you. I think I wrote myself at some point.
Well, God, I don't know where to start. I saw your show, blew me away. There's a friend of mine who's He's British. And I was like, have you heard of this guy, Darren Brown? And he was like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, I love it. Just this great thing. Like, you are a UK phenomenon. And now you're bringing this, this great phenomenon, this great show to the US. And we'll get into the show, but as we normally do on the podcast, I actually want to back up and talk about your childhood. Like, where did you grow up? Where are you from?
So I'm from south of London in a fairly, I don't know what the equivalent would be, but a place called Purley, which is part of Croydon, which it's a very sort of middle class, fairly sort of drab, I think it's probably okay to say, kind of place. And then I, too close to London to have anything going on, at least when I was there. I'm 48 now, so it's a while ago. And then I ended up studying in Bristol, which is a beautiful, leafy city in the west of England. And I stayed there for a long time. But yeah, originally just sort of suburbia.
So when did the love for, like, is it magic? Is it all illusions? This, is, like, what do you call it?
What about, well, I don't know. I've managed to avoid any kind of labels in England, which is great. I mean, that's a really nice situation to be in back home. But here it's slightly fiddlier because I do need to, at some point, pin down and say what I do. I started off, when I studied law and German at Bristol University. And I realized early on I didn't want to be a lawyer or a German. so I saw a hypnotist perform in my first year, and it was kind of extraordinary. And it wasn't one of those shows of people being embarrassed. It was sort of just fascinating. So I left that night determined to learn how to do that. So I did. So I started off as a hypnotist, and I was doing shows and that kind of thing. And then it's a difficult job to really make a living out of unless you're prepared to do the tackiest sort of show that often gets done. I didn't want to do that. So I started doing magic tricks, close-up magic, because this guy that I'd seen, the hypnotist, also did a few tricks informally afterwards.
Like sleight of hand, misdirection.
Exactly,
kind of
So he was kind of my only sort of really role model at that time. So I did that, and then I ended up earning a living as a magician. But the psychological stuff and the suggestion-based stuff has always interested me more, because that's really where I started. So I was veering it all the time into this world of sort of psychological effects and psychological illusions, mind reading rather than, you know, finding your playing card. And I wrote a couple of books for magicians that made me well known in that world. Mm-hmm. And then in 2000 or 99, probably 99, 98, 99, a TV company were looking for someone to be a mind reader on British TV because it hadn't been done for a long time. And I did. And then they signed me up eventually. They spent a couple of years looking for somebody like me, liked me, and then signed me up. And I had my first TV show in the UK in 2000. And it also then brought with it a wave of sort of mentalism as a bit of a thing. There were mentalists around before me, certainly. There was sort of Kreskin and people like that here. And but it certainly, for a good chunk of time before I got going in the UK, it wasn't really particularly anything that was popular. I think now there's a lot more magicians as they get into magic now. This sort of mind reading thing is a lot more popular, which is probably largely my fault. But yeah, that's how it all started.
So it was your early 20s then? Like, I thought you were doing it from when, like, sleight of hand stuff when you were a little kid.
No, not really. I had a magic set when I was young, as a lot of kids do.
like cut the rope, do the rings.
Yeah, exactly, all that. And I sort of then forgot about it. No, it was when I was later at university. I think I was that thing of magic's like the quickest, most fraudulent route to impressing people. So if you need that in your life because you're underconfident or you don't feel impressive, it's a great way of making that happen, of impressing people. And it's easy because you're cheating. So people go, oh, you're amazing. You should be on television. And it might be something you've just pulled out of a Christmas crack. You know, and people don't, how do you know whether it's something that's taken years of skill or something that's just a trick deck of cards, whatever. So it's a very easy way of getting that sort of reaction. For me, that was very important, but certainly, yeah, more so around sort of university age and the desire to perform. I was probably quite sort of insufferable, I think, at that time.
Yeah, well, early
20s. We all look back and find ourselves excruciating, don't we? That's early, part of growing up, isn't it?
Early 20s, yeah. I thought I could rule the world, but now in my late 30s, I still think I can, but who knows? The interesting thing for me, I was reading up about neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, and along those lines, I suspect that you're probably controlling this entire interview right now.
I am.
You're dropping hints somehow for me. What is NLP, for those who don't know?
NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, is a sort of, I'd say, academically discredited, but sort of interesting world. I get associated with a lot, and I've had some peripheral involvement with it. I'm always very careful not to sort of claim that I'm using it, because then people get upset because they say, oh, no, he's not. And so I never really claim I do anything in particular, but it's sort of a little bit like hypnosis without the hypnosis. It was started by these guys, Richard Bandler and John Grinder, I think, or Grinder. I don't know if you can still say Grinder nowadays. in the, I don't know, maybe 70s. It's a sort of language of persuasion, and it's the sort of stuff we might associate with salesmen and therapists. And so, and it borrows from lots of different areas. So I think with the areas that it borrows from, I find quite interesting. There's a lot of persuasion in what I do, and a lot of my toolkit, if you like, is language and the ongoing experience of the audience. Mm-hmm. And I'm using the techniques of the magician as well as the hypnotist and everything. But rather than a magician with decks of cards or clever boxes and so on, it's people's experience in the audience that I'm working with. There's very little in the way of, you know, props and so on. So that whole world of how language affects us and how we form our narratives, that's really what interests me. The show is about the stories that we live by, the way that we mistake stories for reality. And it only really hit me after 18 years of touring in the UK that magic, which had always struck me as quite a childish thing about, you know, impressing people, actually was quite a good analogy for how we edit and delete our ongoing experience of the world and turn it into a story. Because a magician, I'm waffling, I realize, but actually this is sort of what the show's about. A magician sells you a story, and you realize when you join up the dots and reach this impossible moment at the end of it that you've just edited and deleted a whole lot of stuff and turned it into this amazing story. But we do this every day with life, don't we? We have this.
Our brain fills in the gaps.
Our brain fills in the gaps. Yeah. But the same thing that's happening with the magic trick is sort of happening in life. Sometimes we're also being manipulated to do it, but if not, we just do it anyway. We find the things that confirm what we already believe and the things that fit in neatly. We ignore the things we don't believe or we don't find important, and we join up the dots and form this story. And occasionally it's good to be reminded that it is just a story, because then it can free us up in important ways.
Reading people in general, I mean, you said, I expect you to say like, oh yeah, NLP, that's what I studied, that's how it is. But like you claim to not have any psychic powers. You claim to not, you know, not know
I claim to not have a lot of things. I just don't like to claim anything in particular that
right.
I do.
So, but the mind, I mean, it's just mind reading. It's observation. And I hope we can talk about this. It's okay. Mm. There's a section in the show where...
No spoilers.
Okay, we won't even go to sections. So reading people and learning their stories.
Yeah.
And you... Oh, God, I want to die.
It's a show of mind reading.
It's a show of mind reading
and influence and audience participation.
Some of the stuff that you read while I was there blew me away.
Sure.
Yeah. Just blew me away. And I'm trying to think of what I can and can't say. I can't see much of anything. Goodness. All right. Everybody go see the show. End of interview. Fine.
It's difficult. It's difficult to talk about. I mean, I think I've done these shows for a while, and early on, I swore the audiences to secrecy. And it's a really helpful thing, because not only does it... Well, it just preserves a certain type of experience when you come and sit. I think if you come in expecting certain things to happen, it just sort of changes it. So yeah, it's then really difficult to... talk about. But I know what you're getting at. There are bits in the show where I am just doing this kind of mind reading with the audience, and there are sort of warnings I make about as to how involved people want to be, because I don't always have full control over what gets revealed about people. But if your question is at heart, how is it done? Which would be a very sensible question.
Yes.
It's a sort of variety of techniques, and I'm basically using. I've got one foot in that world of, you know, fake psychics and charlatans, and using some of their techniques, but you know, with a different kind of morality behind it, and techniques that date back to the 30s, principally, which is sort of the golden age of stage mind reading, and it's hard to say because I know this is just frustrating when I sort of half explain something, but. I can imagine what it looks and sounds like, but the key to it is, as I say on the show so many times, it's about the stories that we form, and it's making it very hard for you in the audience to think outside of these sort of parameters that I'm setting. But I could, you know, I could play you a video of it. I won't do this, at least not until I have a couple of martinis. But sit down and freeze frame and go, look, I'm doing that, and you'd go, oh, I see. So it's that. It isn't magic, and it isn't like real mind reading in the sense of just reaching into someone's head and mm-hmm. telling you what they're thinking of. But I think it's as close as you can get to it. But it's about creating the effect of that, creating this sort of feeling of that in a room. And then once you get caught up in that, it's very hard to think outside that box. But that's sort of the point of the whole show, that we get caught up in these stories and then we mistake it for reality. Yeah. That's kind of the point.
Yeah, you're creating this narrative. That's a perfect way to put it. That, yeah, I was so caught up in it, I didn't even think about it, that you're creating this narrative that now we are inside this box that you have perfectly crafted.
Yeah.
And so we know, we're just eating out of your hand, more or less.
That's the right, best way of putting it.
Yeah, so you're doing a good job of that. I actually have a question from a Patreon patron of mine. She was asking if it's hard to make personal relationships, because I would feel like if I was going on a date with you, or if I was hanging out with you, or whatever it is, I'd be like, is he going to find out something I don't want him to know? Or is he reading into me? Or like, can people lie to you still? Can, you know, the normal white lies of life, of friendship?
It's hard to judge all this because I've only got my own, you know, head to look out of. But I suppose in a nutshell, if what I do professionally is control things that you can't normally control in life, I think I live by the opposite rule in real life, which is more of a stoic maxim of you can only control your thoughts and your actions. So you should only try and control those things. If you try and control all the stuff you can't control, like what other people do and think and all the rest of it, all the things I do on stage, you're actually just creating frustration and anxiety for yourself. And the Stoic movement was a 2,000-year-old, highly popular philosophy, to the extent it was sort of what the Christians had to win over when they sort of exploded onto the scene. And it was all this idea of it's not events in the world that cause your problems, but it's your reactions to those events. That is a basic sort of law of Stoicism, or a basic sort of principle that you can only control the things, you can only control your own thoughts and actions. So, but in real life, I think I'm probably very different. I'm also quite introverted, and the things that just make me not really predisposed to want to go out and manipulate the world to my own ends. So I don't. When I first started, and I think I was, you know, a sort of insecure wannabe performer and attention seeker and the rest of it, then I did. I was much more, I saw everything in terms of opportunities for influence and suggestion and so on, but it's just insufferable. And also part of that is the desire to impress, which again is, you know, there's a real thing with any sort of magic that because you've got this shortcut to impressing people, you end up just relying on that. So you look at a lot of older magicians and you can tell they've never really had to learn real social skills. You know, there's a real sort of oddness to a lot of older magicians. And I think it's actually getting over all that stuff that makes you have proper relationships in life. And you realize that people don't like someone that's trying to impress them. I mean, that's just not how we... Like, we all try and be funny and witty and impress people, but that's the last thing we like from other people, isn't it? We don't warm to people that are doing that. We warm to people that are kind and, you know, nice and lovely and all those things.
It's tiring. It's tiring to be around somebody who's trying to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, it's not how we make connections, is it?
Yeah. I would hope that if I had the skill like that, that I would be upgraded to first class when I flew every time. Mm. You know? I mean, like, you can get me first class. Can't you? Wink, wink.
The only thing that's remotely happened like that is I've been banned from not quite all, but pretty much all casinos in the UK. But it sounds much more exciting than it is. A lot of them share the same security system software. So once you get banned from one, suddenly you can't walk into any others. So that's exciting. But that wasn't me going out and trying to, you know, whatever the word is, take over the casinos or take down the casinos. It was just, card counting and stuff that if they catch you doing, it's not illegal, but they can ask you to leave. And then you then find the next place you try and get into doesn't let you in.
But wouldn't
that's about the limit of it. It does sound quite exciting.
Wouldn't a mentalist make a great poker player?
Yeah, because I'm terrible at poker because I don't enjoy it.
Can you read people? Can you read their tells?
Yeah, and I've done that. I've explored that. I've explored it for TV stuff, as in kind of let's, do a program on this or an experiment on this. Taught an old lady to do it in one of the... Well, I did a series called Trick or Treat where people would sort of... I'd sort of infiltrate someone's life and they'd pick a trick or treat card and there was a lady in her sort of, I think, 70s, late 70s, who picks a trick card and then she... picks a treat card and I teach her how to play poker at that level and then send her in and play a sort of a world-class game. And it was great. I won't spoil the ending in case anybody sees it, but it was that was good fun. But I'd much rather do that than play myself. I'm just not interested in gambling. Scrabble, I play Scrabble before a show and I enjoy chess and that's it.
Well, the show itself, Secret, which is now running on Broadway, it had an amazing run off-Broadway. At the Atlantic.
It was great fun, yeah.
So, I guess first off, let's start off. Why decide to bring why the new show and then why Broadway or off Broadway at the time?
Okay, so I've toured in the UK for nearly 20 years and had a TV career for as long or a little longer, and it's just always sort of been there as a thing to do at some point. The TV shows haven't really the last few years. There've been some shows on Netflix here, but we've always just sort of held back from the sort of American world in case that ever just opened up and became a thing and then I could do new material for here. Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, it just came up as an opportunity to do this off-Broadway show. I have zero ambition about what I do, genuinely. So this is not really me. This isn't me going, I got to do Broadway, but it came up as an opportunity. And people that I work with and produce me and so on, they've got all of that business-minded thing. I just like doing what's fun. So the appeal for me was just to live in New York for a few years and the joy of doing the show that I really enjoy doing. So it was 4 months of living in New York and playing at the Atlantic. It all seemed amazing. The theatre was lovely. And then those business-minded people were looking out for an opportunity to take it further. And it is amazing. The experience of doing the show, as in standing on stage and doing a show, it doesn't really matter where you are. You're staring into a spotlight and it doesn't particularly matter if you're in a small provincial theatre somewhere in an obscure corner of the UK or whether you're playing Broadway, but you're treated very differently. And and audiences are very different here. There's a real warmth and an energy to audiences here that it's not really the same in UK. It's a different sort of, at home we have a sort of wodge of a response, like gasping or laughing or whatever, but it's like a homogenous group thing, whereas here it's like just individuals. No way! Because this kind of shouting and which is lovely. Plus, also interesting here. If I've got half or maybe a third of the audience of that sort of older, proper Broadway audience, so I don't think know me at all, but maybe they've heard the show's good or something and they've come to see it. And like at the Atlantic, there were sort of subscription members that were coming to have a little sleep or see a play and not really quite sure what they were seeing. And then the other, like another third or the other half at the Atlantic, were like proper fans that were flown in. And it's lovely seeing this audience of very different parts just really come together by the end of it. It's a lovely experience on stage. I'm very aware at the start, there are these, it's demographically a very kind of diverse group from that point of view. And it's lovely feeling it all kind of congeal by the end.
Well, the stage door experience is more of a Broadway thing, right? Not a UK.
The
stage door experience? Like people, you coming to the stage door, people wanting your autographs, talking to you after the show. Do you do that?
I don't do it quite so much now because it kills my voice. I think with a one-man show, it's very hard to go out and spend another half an hour talking, sadly. So I do go out, but normally I have people that come around anyway. And by the time I go out, there's a few people left, and that's fine. But if it's a big crowd, I have to not do it, which kills me actually, because it's a really nice thing to do, particularly when you're in another country, because it just is, and it just feels amazing that people have flown in and so on. It's wonderful. But yeah, there's a whole machinery around Broadway, and you're treated as a star, which just doesn't happen on the West End in London at all. You're very much just a guy doing a job, mm-hmm. even if the show's a big hit. And here, that's amazing. There's the mad world of unionization, which is kind of so new for us, because like at home, it's just six people that just everyone mucks in and makes it work. And here, there's like, you know, 50 people with very specific jobs. You have to be very careful, you know, that you don't interfere or touch something that is the prop guy's job to do that and all that. So that's kind of, that was interesting. And they're all just phenomenal. Everyone's amazing at their job here, and everyone's lovely. And admittedly, maybe this is partly because it's a one-man show, so I've got like I'm very well supported. It'd be different if I was a cast of, you know, 30, but I'm just blown away by how great everybody is, and how just the atmosphere of going to work every day is amazing. And this sort of bubble of just being treated nicely and all of that. It's lovely. I mean, you can go mad if you mistake that for reality. So it's quite nice to do it for a few months. I can see how it might create monsters if you mistake it for real life. But yeah, it's a really lovely experience.
I enjoy, because this is in New York, I guess people around here are less crazy when, you know, they see celebrities walking down the street. Like, I've been here for almost 12 years, and I'm like, oh, there's Alec Baldwin. And I sat next to Elizabeth Banks at the zoo the other day. And I like that, what I've heard from big Broadway celebrities and other people on the podcast is that, like, they're, you know, they come in the stage door and they do the autographs and they're there forever and it's great. And then they, like, turn the corner and they just blend right in and can go back to, like, I'll put in air quotes, a normal life, yeah. Right? Like, they can ride the subway and not get mobbed, and they can get their Starbucks and it's not a big deal. Mm. And I just, there's no question here. I'm just saying it's part of the New York experience, in my opinion, on coming here, especially from the UK and being on Broadway and getting out there. And our media here is so good to get Broadway out there, to get the shows out there. So
yeah, it's a really, really lovely experience. I wish we could do with just a little bit of this back home, whatever it is. Also, just the sheer amount of money involved here is a different world, and I suppose that makes a difference. And a generally just more positive attitude, I think, there is here than we have at home. It's very different. And I know I'm going to miss it. I will miss it when I go back.
So I want to get back to the show and the mentalism a little bit, because like sometimes I'll walk into a party, I'll walk into a room, I'll walk into a place, and then there's energy you can feel from people. There's something that are like, oh, they're hiding something, or they need a lot of attention, or like I can tell quickly with certain people, like, at least I assume certain things, and maybe it's an assumption because I'm just untrained. But has there been anything in your life and your experience where you've just been really just blown away by something that you've discovered or something that you've found out about someone that you hoped wasn't true?
And then it was. It's interesting doing the show because what I find interesting is how we can see very quickly in microcosm how somebody I throw frisbees out to choose people, how somebody catches a frisbee and stands up. I know how they're going to be on stage from that, and then how they are on stage, you know, how they're going to be in life. I mean, and so I've learned throughout the show, I have to really kind of go with my gut instinct in terms of whether I use people or not, because I have to choose people at random, but at the same time, sometimes have to reject people, or it's that's become a very, and that's not about discovering people's secrets or anything like that. There's a lot of that in the show, but just for just how you can get a person in one small moment. And of course, being in a room of people, a whole audience, let alone being on stage in front of them, this is just standing up in the audience, is like an intensification, isn't it, of what it is in real life, how we deal with people that we meet. So it's a very to me, just that situation is very, very telling in terms of what people do with that strangeness and anxiety of just suddenly being in front of loads of people. The thing I actually really learned from doing the show is what to do with nerves. Because when I was noticing when people come up on stage, if they're just nervous, the room loves them, right? Because you're all feeling, oh, that could be me up there. You have this sort of vicarious warmth. And if I at all made a joke that was ill-judged at their expense, I could, you know, feel the audience turn against me. Whereas if a lot of people come up and they turn the nerves into something else, like they're going to be a joker or they're going to try and spoil the trick, or they're going to be strangely odd and detached and sort of unimpressed by everything. All the stuff we do in real life all the time when we're nervous. And the room hates them. You can feel everybody turning against them. And now they're suddenly on my side. So it doesn't bother me at all if people are like that, because I know I've got the room on my side, which is an odd thing. But after seeing this year after year, I just thought, God, what a great lesson for just how to be in life. It's something I really learned from the show, that if you're nervous, it's fine. Let that sit, because people warm to it. It feels very vulnerable, makes you feel very alone and very disconnected. But actually what's happening is everybody's leaning into you, and, you know, and just don't turn it into all the other stuff we do, because it just turns everybody off. So it doesn't quite answer your question, but things like that, in terms of just things that I've got from people at that level, in terms of sort of, you know, the sort of mind reading or discovering, occasionally things have come out on the show, which I've sort of gone with a gut feeling on something, like yesterday declaring someone was pregnant and she'd only just found out, she hadn't announced it to anybody, and I'm sort of going, oh, I'm sorry, is that all right for me to say that? She's like, oh, yeah, I haven't told anybody. So occasionally stuff like that, I sort of, but then I've also said, look, stuff is going to come out during this, and if you don't want to be part of it, please don't come back for the second half. So that sort of thing happens sometimes. But generally what I'm doing is creating a sort of an illusion. I'm creating an effect, as we call it, you know, a kind of a story again that you're telling yourself. So it's not like I'm really walking around in real life going, oh, that person's having an affair. It's not quite like that. You just give the impression that's what you can do.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. I just want to bring up the show. I can't. Okay. Speaking of people who catch frisbees and don't, I'm sitting here with Dory, who's running audio for me, who actually caught the frisbee, mm-hmm. handed it to me, and I came up on stage.
Yes, because no one has to get involved if they don't want
right.
to.
So I came up on stage, and you were like, yeah, this guy's got a podcast, right? You could tell immediately.
Oh, clearly, yes. Totally. Clearly a brilliant podcast. And now you've got me on it, strangely.
Right. Dory, you had questions. I know you wanted to ask.
I have so many questions. But I'm like Alan, I can't ask most of them. But I do, I'm curious because, you know, you are so trained in psychology and law and mentalism and all of that. But your command of the stage, your ability to communicate as an actor, you know, on top of everything, is just so spectacular.
Oh,
and
thank you.
The room is, from the first second, is just completely transfixed. And so I'm wondering, did you have any training as an actor? Did you have any, you know, to public speaking, or how did you marry those two worlds? Because you own it.
Oh, lovely thing to say. Thank you. No, I didn't, but I've done the shows for 20 years, and I think they've varied. When I look back on the earlier shows, I think I was getting by just on a sort of just energy, just kind of like hitting the audience with the show. As I've grown up and got a bit older, and that's, I'm just, you know, less like that in life, I think I probably hit different notes throughout the show, which I think gives it a different feel and maybe helps with that, because those are the things that keep audiences engage, the sort of shifting notes, as you would as an actor. And it is a sort of acting, because I'm taking something that's large, in terms of the stuff that I'm saying, is kind of a script, and it's, you know, I'm saying the same stuff from night to night, and you have to make that feel fresh and like you're sort of making it up on the spot. So I do think of it in those terms. But I don't know how I'd be if I was actually sort of in a play. I'd love to do a play. I'd love the idea of sharing that experience with other people and not having the whole burden of it on yourself. But it's a very safe sort of acting, because then you're also just sort of, at the moment, I'm just playing myself. I'm just playing this charismatic version of myself, which is lovely. So I think it's just come from doing, and also working with a director forever as well, Andrew O'Connor and Andy Nyman, who both also write the show with me. So the three of us have done these things from day one. And I think I love the sort of those strange technical sides of it. Like, you know, you know the audience is losing interest because they cough, you know. So not at the moment with an older audience and this time of year, there's a lot of coughing, and hopefully that's not all on me. But when you start to hear coughs where you don't normally hear coughs, you're losing the audience. So your instinct is to start leaning in and talking a bit louder and upping your energy. And of course, you mustn't. You have to do the opposite. You have to pull back and you have to go very quiet, because then people need to lean in more. So suddenly they're on the edge of their seat again, which is where you want them. So all that kind of stuff, and all the voice projection, all of those things that are very kind of actory techniques. I love all of that. It's all the hidden stuff. I really enjoy that sort of hidden technical side of it. It's almost like another magic trick in a way. I do enjoy that. And it's nice occasionally for that to get noticed, just that sort of aspect of it, because people don't very often ask me about it. So that is nice. But yeah, that's the answer. I think it's just from doing it a lot, and just it's a very easy mode for me to slip into. But I don't know how I'd be if I was actually, you know, in a play having to properly act. I don't know.
Well, you said, do you have a follow-up on that?
Well, no, you mentioned you're really an introvert.
Yeah.
And, you know, to step on stage for that first time and to, you know, without that training, you know, understanding where that came from in you, you know, is really fascinating.
And I started performing quite early at university, and at the time I was a real attention seeker. So I probably wasn't introverted as such then, because I hadn't quite settled into anything comfortable. I was just desperate for attention. So performing came easy. And when I started my first shows, I used to sit on stage with a semicircle of empty chairs, because I'd have people up. These were hypnosis shows, so it was for people to come up and take part as the audience were coming in. And I did that because it avoided waiting in the wings to walk out on stage, because that's where the nerves are when you can't do anything. You're just waiting to step out. So I thought, I don't want to be experiencing that. So I'll just sit on stage. And also, it's quite imposing. And then as I grew up and the need to perform in real life sort of subsided and just became, you know, kind of the thing I do as a job, and it was taking care of all of the sort of need for attention. I'd already found that mode very comfortable. But I think it's quite a common thing. I think most performers probably are a little introverted, mm-hmm. or maybe, I mean, you've interviewed a lot of them, or maybe the opposite. But I think even if they're, you can get very good at having an extrovert exterior, but in terms of where you, it's all about where you recharge, isn't it? I think if you recharge essentially on your own, which I know I do, and even a lot of actors, I'm sure, seem very extroverted, I think probably still just want quiet to recharge. And as opposed to an extrovert, that kind of recharges by being in company. That's really all it is. And your threshold for kind of having had enough. The other night I went out to have a drink with some people. Then we went on to another place for another drink. And it occurred to me at the age of 48, it was the first time I'd done that in my life. First time I'd gone on somewhere else. Well, isn't it? This is Broadway, baby.
That's the New York mentality there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I just have a, you know, I have a fairly low threshold for sort of just feeling, you know, just kind of done. I think, again, that's sort of common amongst my people.
Yeah.
Introverts, not mentalists.
You said two things, actually. One was that your character on stage, it is a character. It's a more charismatic version of yourself. And then you said something just a second ago that was that once your desire to perform in real life subsided, you went on. So you're introverted, but you want, like, you find comfort on stage in being this big guy, this big projection of yourself. Is that like you obviously don't use that to recharge, because you said you need quiet and to be by yourself to recharge. But like, I'm trying to get at like the psychological aspects of this.
Psychology of it. It's a very lovely adrenaline filled experience. I get to do a show that I know is a good show. I hope that doesn't sound sort of conceited to say, but it's very different, I guess, if you're an actor going out and doing a play that you just know isn't very good. It must be a very demoralizing experience. So it's a very nice experience to go out and do a show that you feel you sort of own and feels like a good show. So that's nice. It's also a show that's really good fun to do. Hopefully it's fun to watch and come out of and all the rest of it, but it's, you know, I always leave on a high. So that's, and if I've had a bad day, or, you know, just have just fallen into a bit of a rut or whatever during the day just because I've had nothing to do, or I'm, you know, I'm writing a lot at the moment. So if that, maybe I've just had a bad day with that or whatever. This, doing this show just completely sort of cleans you out. It's like a, it's a, it's just a amazing, fun thing to do. And I, that, but it's not like a real life. It's not the equivalent of like going out to a party or something. I wouldn't enjoy that. It's a, it is this sort of oddly controlled thing, but also it's the sort of experience where I'm so on my feet. It's not a show that you're just recreating every night, not repeating every night, rather. You have to recreate it, but not repeat it, as any actor, I'm sure, would say the same thing. So, but given that my fellow cast members are people in the audience that could do or say anything, it's a very kind of, you know, on your toes sort of thing, which puts you into that flow state that has been spoken about. There's a guy called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's mm-hmm. a sociologist. Sure, you've come across this. Talks about the flow state where your set of challenges meet your skills, and when that's a sort of X equals Y line, when the two things are meeting and playing off each other, whether you're playing chess or surfing or doing a show or it could be anything, you're in this sort of flow state, which is generally what people describe as their sort of prime state. So that's a very lovely thing, and it is a bit different from, it doesn't reflect how I'd be spending my time normally, which probably would be tucked away somewhere writing in a coffee shop. That's where I feel I kind of do recharge. But it's just another lovely thing to do, and having the contrast of doing both is great. I mean, there's nothing like it. It's a really lovely stretch of experience to have for a few months.
Well, I guess what I was trying to go with this, wondering if there was anything there, was like the need to feel in control without being out there, but being out there, but having it be a character. So it's not really you, right? So like going,
it sort of is me now. There's very little difference. I think of it in terms of a character, in that only in terms of I'm not that not quite that sort of, you know, witty and charismatic in real life all the time. Some of the time on a good day, but it's me. It's not. I'm not. I think it has to be you, because otherwise there'd be no longevity to what you're doing. It would, you know, you'd tie yourself out. So it is me. It's not a character in that sense. But I tend to think of it like that, because the bit where it's a character to me is the kind of, oh, he can get in our minds and read our minds. That's not. I can't quite do that in real life, given the compared to the promise of what it looks like on stage. So that's where the character comes in. But in terms of, if you strip away that kind of skill base, the questionable skill base of what I'm actually doing, and just in terms of how I am as a person, I think that's me. It's just a sort of a heightened version in a suit.
Do you ever get nervous at all that just the audience is not going to cooperate, that things, I mean, it is a script and you've got a set format.
I have one moment every single night, and you may know what it is from having seen it, when I'm waiting in silence for something to happen and for the audience to respond in a way. And every single night, I think it won't happen. This will be the night it doesn't happen. And every night sometimes it does brilliantly, and sometimes I just about scrape through on that bit. But it's never not happened. But yeah, every single night. But it's not really nerves. I sort of enjoy it. I'm going through my head, right, what's the backup again? What do I do if this doesn't work? Trying to remember the last time it happened, which was maybe, you know, 3 years ago or something. So no, I don't get nervous. I had an experience of getting a thing wrong in the first half of the show, and I got it wrong three nights in a row. This was, I think, back in England at some point. I was warming the show up there. And the first night it went wrong, and it was a thing that, if you're doing any sort of magic, is familiar to you, where you mess up at the very start. You know you messed up, and no one else knows. Mm-hmm. But you now know this whole thing is going nowhere. So you're frantically trying to find ways of getting out of it and double back. But while you're thinking that, you're continuing on a sort of autopilot, and it's becoming more and more absurd to do that. So at some point, you just have to go, okay, this is just going to fail. This bit's going to fail. It's not the end of the world. This bit just won't work. But like 10 minutes of leading someone that's going to go nowhere. So I had that. It happened on one night, and I was sweating, and I was panicking. And also, you realize there's as much as you want to love the audience, there's a kind of a note of hostility, because you're trying to fool them at some level, and just how what it can spin on, like can spin on a dime. And when you feel something is failing, suddenly like that whole audience feel like they're hostile. Like they're all there the night before. They know what's supposed to happen. Now they're just looking at you. They can see through you. They can see you're a fraud, and it's a horrible thing. And then, but afterwards, 5 minutes afterwards, or 2 minutes afterwards, they were all back on board. That thing hadn't worked, and they were laughing at the next point. They were all supposed to laugh. So I thought, okay, it was fine. So the second night it happened, didn't bother me quite as much. The third night it happened, it was me making the same stupid mistake 3 times in a row. I was just narrating this experience. I was just kind of saying, oh, I've messed it up. This is what I'm feeling. I'm probably going to, it's not going to work. I'm now sweating. I've got this. But it wasn't really bothering me. And it was the last little bit of tension that kind of got released, that last potential for hostility. And then the next night I went out thinking, so what if I could just properly love the audience rather than still having that little note of hostility? And what would that mean? Which sounds really sappy. And it sounds odd as well after 18 years of touring to be thinking that. But it was sort of an amazing little shift that may not have read to anybody else, but in terms of stuff you want to bring out with you when you step out. Because it changes then how you... There's ideas that I'm trying to communicate in the show, and there's a real difference between communicating those ideas with a feeling of love and a feeling of thinking about 6 other things that you're trying to balance at the same time. So that was a really lovely thing. Again, I'm only describing my kind of own internal experience of things, which is not really necessarily that interesting, but it's a show about people. It's a show about the audience, and it's a show which is unusual for magic. Normally, the show's about the magician. If you're any sort of magician, it's about you looking clever. This is, I think, probably unique in the world of whatever that is. That it's not. It's definitely about the audience. So it's, I love, and I'll take anything that increases that feeling of a connection with the people. With the people that have sat there. I really enjoy it. And the fact that it doesn't come always easily to a performer. You may look like you've got this guy on stage that adores you, but probably he's not, or she isn't. There's probably a million other things they're thinking about, or they might even be doing it on autopilot. So you can't take it for granted that that's happening. So to really kind of really lean into that, and that the show is conducive to that because it's very much about people and is about the audience. That's a really nice thing to explore as a performer. And when it's you. I'm not playing a part. I'm not playing somebody else. So it's a very nice little sort of world to a nice experience to be having up there on stage.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it. I think everybody needs to go see it.
I agree. Twice, ideally. 2 or 3 times.
Yes. So there's 3 standard questions I ask to wrap up every podcast. The first one is, what motivates you?
What motivates me has only ever been what is enjoyable and interesting. Genuinely never had any ambition, as I said, never thought beyond the thing I'm doing at the time. So enjoyment and interest, that's it.
All right.
At the time. Yeah.
And second question, what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now starting out down a similar path?
If there's a formula for success, it's talent plus energy. And as any good Stoic would say, those are the 2 things that you can control. You can develop your talent, and you can develop the energy that you put it out there into the world with. If you have loads of talent, no energy, it's not going to get very far. And if you have all the energy but no talent to back it up, it's not going to get you very far either. The point is, though, you only need to focus on those 2 things, and they're both things that are under your control. All the rest of it, what other people do, whether you get the job, the right phone call, whether the fates collide in the right way, is fortune. And we used to have a respect for fortune, that there's this other half of life that we can't control. And we've sort of forgotten that. And I think particularly in a very positive, goal-setting sort of culture like it is here, it really gets forgotten about. And the trouble with that, it's great to think positively, of course, but the problem is then that if things go wrong, you've then got failure to add to a whole list of problems. Like you didn't believe in yourself enough. And I think having a healthy respect for stuff goes on in life that we have no control over, and that those things are fine. We can decide those things are fine. All the things that we can't control outside of our thoughts and actions, we can decide are fine. That doesn't mean we shouldn't go out and change the world if we want to. But even then, there's a difference between me doing my very best to change the world and emotionally committing to outcomes that are not under my control and may happen a generation later after I'm dead. And you only do a better job if you sort of do distinguish between those things. And I think in any kind of creative career, being able to go, it's just my talent and energy, and I don't have to get caught up in the madness of what are other people doing? How come they got the job? How come they're getting paid more than me? How come? None of those things. All of those things are fine. And if you let that thought drip into your soul and have faith that it's true, and not just you're trying to fool yourself with it and make yourself feel better. I think that there's a real relief in that, and it frees you up to do better work and ultimately, I think, be more successful. And Bryan Cranston has a really nice thing. He talks about going to auditions and how your job as an actor is just to present your character at an audition. It's not to get the job. That is not your job. Your job is not to get the job. Your job is to present yourself well and present the text in a compelling way and so on. It's again, very good sort of stoic advice. If you look for him on YouTube, it's a really great watch.
Okay, so final question then. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life.
I'm not very good at sound bites. Apologies. Sorry, but go on.
Oh, no. It doesn't need to be a sound bite. Yeah. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I don't think I would. I can think of a small handful of things I've loved. The thought of going back and seeing them again and again, you just get sore. So I'd pass up on that. It sounds like a sort of torture.
All right. So where can we find you online? What are your social handles?
My social, I'm on Twitter. I'm at Derren Brown. It's DERREN, which is a strange spelling, at Derren Brown. I'm on Instagram as well, the same thing, at Derren Brown. I do a lot of street photography, so I put some of my stuff on there too. That's it, really. I'm DerrenBrown.co.uk, which is my website. I think that's it. It's probably about the extent of my social media foray.
Oh! Yeah, the show.
I'm forgetting
website.
The important one.
Yeah.
Also, very importantly, DerrenBrownSecret.com is the page for the show. So that's where people can get tickets and find out more about the show. And I'm running till January, so I've still got a little while to go.
Yeah, cool. All right, you can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com or broadwaypodcastnetwork.com/TTP. You can find me online at theater_podcast on Instagram and Twitter, facebook.com/officialtheaterpodcast. Please leave a rating, a review. I love to read those. This is edited by Matthew Hendershot. Thank you to Jukebox the Ghost for the intro and outro music. And Derren Brown, thank you for being the guest on today's episode.
Thank you.
Colorful. Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.